You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for missionaries and leaders living out their God-given calling through this small expression of the church. This podcast is meant to encourage, equip, and contribute to the overall discussion of this smaller way. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy. You're listening to Microchurches, a podcast for people brave enough to be small. This is your host, Tommy Wilkerson, and in this season, we are looking at microchurches and microchurch network leaders from around the country, around the world, figuring out what they're learning as they go about microchurch life. But these particular episodes are a little bit different. It's kind of not necessarily looking at microchurch leadership per se, as much as it's taking a step outward and looking at network leadership as a whole. So this is a follow-up conversation to a conversation that we had started earlier about leadership transitions and decentralized networks. And so this episode, I actually am joined by Taylor McCall. If you remember, he was supposed to just randomly drop into the episode, but this episode, he is actually here. But I also have Jeremy Stevens with us, as well as Lucas and Josh. And so, guys, thank you so much for being on this episode with me. So I guess as a way to rehash, we are sort of talking about the way that prevailing model transitions in leadership happens in a certain way. And decentralized networks, it just looks differently. So it's one thing to hire somebody for a senior pastor role or something like that. And you're maybe looking at, do they have their MDiv? Do they have a certain theological bend? Do they agree with us? Are they a part of our denomination? And there's a way that you can kind of hire out for those positions. Maybe a person comes out and preaches and the congregation decides, do they like that person's sermon? Do they answer certain questions the right way? But because decentralized networks are different, there's an element there that's very much spiritual authority, right? Like, does this person have the spiritual authority to lead this community in this particular fashion? And so we were talking about maybe some of the ways that it's just different. And, you know, a lot of these decentralized networks that are emerging, this is something that they're going to have to deal with years from now, maybe not right now, but if there's a way that we can serve them by having the conversation, we can do that. And so we started by talking about, you know, the difference in maybe something like Dwell, which their community, I mean, has been around since the 70s, and their leadership transitions, as well as maybe the difference between Lucas and the Underground and that leadership transition. And we got into maybe what's different between maybe something that's a little bit more homegrown leadership model versus something that's a little bit more imported. And we kind of settled on the fact that, okay, you can import somebody from somewhere else, but they almost had to have been a part of that community long enough for it to feel like they were a homegrown leader in that community. And so where we left it off that last episode were like the pros and cons. Like, are there pros and cons to either approaches to those leadership transitions? And so I would love for you guys to just hop in anywhere in that and kind of share some of your thinking about, like, yeah, if I had to look at the pros and cons of like bringing somebody in from the outside or the pros and cons of having somebody from within the community arise in the position. Yeah, go ahead and share your thoughts.
I'm trying to remember what all we covered last time. I know one of the things that came up when we were talking about people coming into a network versus people that are raised up within a network is the question of spiritual authority, in the sense of like, what, how is that conferred? You know, where exactly does that come from? And so in a network, typically we're not trying to attach that in the same way, just strictly speaking to positions or titles and things like that. You often, the benefit of having people come up from within the network is that you have people who, they've built that credibility through relationships over the course of time. And so there is something about that which does intentionally deconstruct the sort of traditional model where you've got, like you said, the seminary trained pastor who builds a resume and then sort of just comes in and takes over. In a lot of prevailing church models, you're kind of asking that leader to come in and bring their own leadership culture of some kind. But a lot of times in a network, we don't necessarily want to disrupt the leadership culture. We value what it is that has organically come to be over the course of time there. Not to say that can ever be due for a shakeup or a change, but but I thought that was an interesting thing that we talked about last time, was that question of how does one develop develop spiritual authority and organic influence, the kind of influence necessary for leading you know, a network, something which wasn't necessarily modeled or patterned after something else, but was original in its birthing. I think, Lucas, you talked about that because you were describing what it was like for you to come in from the outside into the Tampa Underground, but you didn't totally come in from the outside because you were involved in an underground sister movement in Chicago. And then you spent significant time absorbing the DNA of the Tampa Underground before you entered into executive. Before you became an elder, I think you're already in executive leadership before you became an elder.
Yeah, it was one of the another little kind of side benefit of the way that the at least Tampa Underground is sort of set up, where you've got the decentralized network of churches. It's the side by side entity. We've got the decentralized network of churches that has like some oversight and governance, but then this platform of services that's separate from it, but its exempt purpose with the IRS is to serve the citywide network of churches. So it was possible. It actually felt okay and reasonable for somebody to come in and be the executive director of the service agency. Even though I was brand new and didn't have a whole lot of spiritual authority in the community, because my role was primarily, not entirely, but primarily about service. Like, I'm just here to serve. And there's just a little bit, I guess this would be true of any transition, but there was a little bit of like, you want to come in and you don't want to, in the early days of like a transition like that, you don't want to change everything overnight. You don't want to like make these massive changes or something like that. You kind of want to go into like learn mode and kind of embed in the context a little bit. But the overcorrection is to like wait too long to change anything, like just never change anything and never sort of, never sort of step into the authority and the calling that the Lord has like given you, because there can be, so over time there can be like maybe a little bit of like an abdication of leadership that you clearly have. So again, there's not like a clear black or white there. It was sort of like you're sort of discerning that tension of running full bore too soon or waiting too long. I remember coming out. I mean, again, Josh, you've got your experience with Dwell. I've got my experience. And you try not to like close your fist around like prescriptive viewpoints based on your own experience. But I definitely feel I definitely came out of my experience feeling like, gosh, I think this would, I think it was good the way that we did it. And I think there was actually like a skill set that was required for the role that there weren't a lot of people locally that I think were like happy and excited to jump into that skill set. And I was, and so that's another factor, right? Yeah. That's another factor of the equation. It's like, you could have an ideal situation where you want somebody to be internal, but at the end of the day, there's like a skill set that's required, and there's calling and there's passion and that kind of stuff. And so, what's possible here? Right, and so possible. I think it was the right move, but I definitely like, learning from that experience, I think I've started to think like I've leaned toward, when possible, it is better to maybe like elevate leaders internally. If they have the right skill set for the job and they're called and they're passionate about it, because of that spiritual authority sort of being overlapped and enmeshed a little bit with relational trust and deeds done, like watching your life, monitoring your life, deeds done. But I've also watched Taylor. That's why I've been really interested in Taylor jumping on, because I've watched like Taylor. Taylor sort of has been involved in he sort of transplanted from one movement to another. And there's something to be said about like a movement having a certain culture, but potentially having like blind spots or weaknesses or something like that. And somebody from the outside coming in and like injecting something new. If you hire from within, you can sort of get insular. And you don't have the ability to sort of like breathe life into some certain blind spots or like inject new DNA or new values, new energy. So I thought his experience and even the way, not just him, but even the way his community, I mean, I've talked to people in his community about them kind of dropping in. And so I don't want to discount that entirely, like that seems to have been a good thing. So I'd love to even hear some some of what he's gleaning from his own experience, you know?
Yeah. Let me see if I can kind of navigate a few thoughts. So, you know, it's interesting thinking about the prevailing model of leadership transition. So I'll start with that thought. I don't know how familiar you guys are with the United Methodist style of, you know, importing itinerant pastoral leadership and what that kind of the origin of that. I think a lot of it is Wesley's idea of itinerant ministry, but it also comes from this kind of, how do I say it, this push against corruption. And I think it, what I would say, so thought one is we can't discount where that came from.
Right.
I mean, what we're doing right now is we're trying to hold a prophetic edge against what we've seen become a perversion of leadership transition. But the current model of leadership transition was a prophetic edge against the former model right. of raising up internal leaders that developed like generations of corruption within a religious order. And to me, that just kind of makes me laugh because it makes me realize what is almost the inevitable realization of anyone that's in this long enough is that everything is bad. Or everything has the potential of
to be bad, to become bad. Yeah,
yeah. To become evil or to become corrupted or to become self-centered, the self rules in that. And so, you know, I think of, so then I'm going to stay on that line of thought. That's one thought we could talk about. So maybe bullet these a little bit, Tomi. But the second one is, I'm reminded often of a conversation that I had with a brother years ago when we were doing some of the work we were starting in Birmingham 13, 14 years ago. And he was a pastor in Seattle and he was asking me to kind of explain to him what we're doing. And this was before any of this was common language of decentralized or distributed networks and nonprofits serving the movement and all this beautiful stuff that we love. And I'm kind of sharing with him all of what we're doing. And the, I think we called them gospel communities at the time. And he was like, what's your role? And I said, I'm the executive director and you can fill in the blanks. But basically when I finished, and this is a good friend who loves me and supports me a lot. And he said, so basically you do everything that I do. You're just using semantics. You call yourself the executive director. You call your small groups this, blah, blah, blah. You call church this. And I think this is an interesting point. I said to him, and I've kind of held to this truth for the entirety of this journey, is I said, no, you do exactly what I do, but you call yourself pastor. And you call your gospel communities, your micro churches, small groups, and you call your large gathering church. Or we might call our large gathering a party. We might call our little movements churches. And I call myself executive director. The reason that's important is because all things considered, with all due respect, you're not a pastor. You're an executive director. Now, you might pastor a handful of people at your home or in your neighborhood. You might counsel some people. So that point is important. Hold on to that for a second. Because I'm asking the question, what are we specifically looking for when we're talking about leadership transition? You already hit on it, Lucas, like what kind of gifting, what kind of skill set? Does that exist within our within our local context? And what type of authority do we need? Mm-hmm. I would say, and I have one more point after this and then we can talk, or I'll share like why this matters to me. But I would say there's three types of authority. Jesus said in like towards the end of Matthew, maybe in the 20th chapter, two dudes are fighting over who's going to be at his right and his left. And he says, I don't have, that's not a position for me to give, it's for the Father to give. And I see that we have like this commanded authority, which is like a dictator type role. Like you will do what I say, maybe a boss in an organization or something like that. We have this really more than a boss, like a dictator. And then we have this second, this positional authority that you mentioned earlier. I call Tomi the executive director, so that's his role. Then we have this third type, this like earned, given, almost like submitted authority. Like I see you as an authority in my life and I want to give you that authority. So here's what I want to say, and y'all challenge this if you want, but I don't see the role that we're talking about as a given authority role. I see it as a positional authority. Now, authority could be given over time, but we're talking about someone to come in and kind of guide, apostolically lead, be a visioneer for our network. And we're saying, yeah, take that position. But we hold to a framework, almost like an ethic, that you're not my spiritual authority. That's not what we teach. Yeah. Like in my home, in my business, place of business, in my ministry movement, I have spiritual authority, elders, overseers in those spaces. We're not talking about replacing that form of leadership. If we are, I think we need to have a slightly different conversation. Right. But if we're talking about network leadership, we're really kind of talking about positional authority. And so when I think about that, I think external is probably the better way to go, but that's in my experience. And that's because I think every scenario is unique in and of itself. Mm-hmm. When you bring in an outside person, you bring in a visionary, maybe a specific skill set, a specific gifting that's not super tied to the pain, the emotions, and the moment of the founding leader leaving. And they're kind of able to, from the outside, separate themselves from all of the turmoil that's existing in this current moment. Should the organization die as it was? Should it transition majorly? How do we handle? And I know I'm speaking to some very specific pain points for three of you, but also for me, and I can say for many leaders that I've known, yeah, who have gone through similar things, having that outside separated heart can be a real asset in that moment.
Yeah.
To be able to be like, dude, I don't know. I'm not taking any sides here. I know what we believe, what we stand for, and where we're going organizationally, what we hold to sacramentally. And so I'm going to hold that for us until it dies, which I think you guys both did. So then I land on final thought of Paul sending Timothy into Ephesus. Why did he do that? Was it a strategy? Was it the best thing for them? I think this is the most non-strategic answer. I think it's because it's what the Spirit of God told him to do. And when it was right for the moment. And I can honestly say for me, I have a preference. If it's a network organizational thing, I think you probably should consider bringing in an outside. But if you want to know what I would push you to as a faith family, beg God to lead you in what to do.
I wrote down some notes about that, the example of Timothy as well, when you were talking. I actually think that's probably the scriptural example that most challenges my experiential paradigm is Paul sending in Timothy to lead in Ephesus. But one thing that I note is that he kind of did both, right?
They
also developed local leadership. He developed eldership. He raised up people from within there. And certainly, as you can tell from the letter of 1 Timothy, that was also part of Timothy's ongoing job, was to continue that process, right?
Yeah, it really seems like there's a chance that Timothy was more of like a network leader.
Yeah, maybe.
And maybe that is a pastor role on some level. Maybe you're pastoring the leaders. But I think in our current organizational context, that's really falls as more of an executive director type type leader, as opposed to a shepherding type leader.
Yeah.
I guess some of it comes down to how you define some of those different leadership roles within your organization and what the overlap is. Like in my, and where I'm coming from, a lot of like we're an elder led church. We have elders, and a lot of our elders also fill different pastoral roles. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. And I think in our organization, people tend to wear a lot of different hats. And so the idea that you would bring in like an executive director who wouldn't have like teaching or pastoral functions, is a little bit outside our paradigm. But I could see when those things are distinct. I think Lucas, your example of this is good, where you're able to kind of come in and work more on sort of like the managerial, and that word can have a negative connotation, but in a definition sense, like a managerial role without necessarily having to operate pastorally or to necessarily.
Lucas, like, who do you pastor?
Vision for the movement from the drop.
My house church. Yeah.
Okay. So
that
exactly what I said earlier.
Right.
You certainly wouldn't call yourself the pastor of the underground.
Correct.
Yeah. But all things considered, you, Jeremy, and Tomi, I've seen you pastor leaders outside
of totally. Yeah. Right.
So
totally.
There's no way that you can be an executive director in the context of what we're talking about of a faith movement and not have a pastoral gifting. But to call yourself the pastor of this organization is theological nonsense.
It's
actually nonsense. And so that's what I mean when I say you call yourself pastor, but you're actually an executive director of the thing you say you're pastor.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
So Taylor, how would I'm curious to hear what you'd say about this in terms of like vetting and selecting, you know, someone from the outside to come into a movement.
I'll concede the point
that like, you know, depending on the situation of the movement, there could be a lot of benefit in someone coming in from the outside. But with that being said, also I feel like one of the things that feels so difficult to me about importing people into a movement is, that movements typically have such a unique character to them that, you know, like there absolutely are, you know, apest leadership types and different personalities and gifting types. So you can assess those things in a high level, but some of those DNA elements are really difficult to translate. And they also, you know, in some aspects of that DNA may be something that a new leader could change and that'd be good. But typically there's also things that you want preserved, you know, when you're thinking about what does it look like to steward this going forward, you know, and so I guess I'm curious as to your experience and your thoughts on what that should look like.
Yeah. That's such a good question. I was thinking about that a lot. I actually, wrote that down, a little lower and didn't hit on it, but I think, see if you guys can describe what I'm saying in some kind of leadership model. I think of almost like an apprenticeship, but I think there has to be almost like a Paul Timothy experience in that transitional process. So when we're trying to solve a problem that's a broken problem, there's only a broken solution. So if we're bringing in a leader to replace a corrupt pastor who was fired for sleeping with the secretary or stealing money, there is no, it's a broken solution. We can't have a good transition there. It's just like, God, please help us, or an executive director. So we're trying to solve a problem of saying, how do we have a healthy transition? And I think let's just leave our names out of it. But I think in the way I would like to see it move is it's kind of like you're coming in, now you're with me, let's say for a 24-month period. And then over that time, then I'm doing this and you're doing this. There's not a let's vet 8 guys. I know all 8 guys, because I'm connected to the faith movements happening throughout the world or throughout the country. We haven't created a silo. Again, that's a broken problem. If you've created your own little protected network that no one's connected to, that's a broken problem that we're trying to now. Now you got to do something from within, and they got to hold all of the master's views, or you got to bring somebody without from outside that's going to kind of strong arm and strong fist this thing like you have. But when you want to be a, we have many guides, but few fathers, right? So when you want to be a father that transitions well, and I'll say from my story, this is what I tried to do, but things didn't necessarily go as I would want them to. But I still think things are, it's hard to talk about my experience because it's so personal. But if someone was to say, is that leader still leading, I don't know, from his own conviction, I would say yes. And are they still dependent on you as a leader? I would say no. And so just from that standpoint, I would go success. He's leading from his conviction. He believes in what he's doing. And I don't have control or authority over the movement. So success in that right. The reason I think bring someone in from outside is because I think they're able to disconnect, like I said earlier, from all of the emotions of the founding journey, all of the emotions of the leaving of the founder. And then there's able to be like a Paul to Timothy transition where you come, you know, what is it? I do, you watch, we talk. I do, you help, we talk. You do, I watch, we talk. You do, I help, we talk. I leave, you do, someone else watches. So I think that could easily happen in a beautiful familial organic faith movement. And I think that kind of happened with you, Lucas. I mean, it was probably frustrating at times, but I think it did, you know? So.
No, it was good. Yeah. Yeah.
I do want to circle back to something, and maybe because in my experience with the underground, it's hard for me to like disentangle these two things, but you said something really interesting, Taylor, about positional authority, like the positional authority of like the executive director, and how that's not necessarily a spiritual authority thing. And maybe spiritual authority isn't necessary in that positional authority as executive director. But as you were kind of speaking and sharing about like, okay, here is, yeah, maybe there's a whole bunch of stuff that's gone down, and this person from the outside who has inherited this role as executive director, they just have to say, hey, well, this is where we're going as an organization. This is the chart, the path that we're charting and the way forward. To me, that still feels very much like a spiritual authority matter. Like the person, like, is it, would the, if there's, if that person who like has the, that role or that title of executive director doesn't somehow have spiritual authority in the life of the communities of the micro churches or whatever gospel communities that are connected to that organization, would they still stick around? Would they just leave? Would they just be like, okay, well, that's what you say, but I don't actually listen to you. And so, yeah, you could say this is where we're heading as an organization.
But bro, listen to what you're saying though. Like that's exactly right. Is they left because Lucas didn't, I mean, let's make it personal. He didn't have spiritual authority, right? Is that correct? So over time, you developed spiritual authority with a new crop, but you came in with positional authority. I'm not saying that if spiritual authority doesn't develop from a leader of a faith movement, then y'all are screwed anyways. I'm saying that's not what we're looking for initially. We need someone with positional authority who knows the vision, don't try to not make what I'm saying totally binary or a false dichotomy. Like,
yeah, it's almost like, because I was thinking the same thing, and I want to hear Jeremy talk to this too, but it's almost like it's possible to bring in somebody into the position to have positional authority without much spiritual authority. It's possible to do that, but very temporarily. Like it has to, it has to develop over time.
But if,
or else you're screwed,
if spiritual authority is a necessary component, then you can't bring someone in from the outside.
Right. Yeah, you got to do it from the beginning.
So I'm saying it's not a necessary component at first.
Yeah.
So I would say that kind of the initial conditions upon which you could like really hire somebody, you know, you really do need a skill set. You need a calling. That person has to have a sense of calling. There has to be an openness to that person. So at least at that level, the community, the organization, and even the organic community has to be open to this person. And if they're not open to it, then I think that's possibly problematic. I would say those are initial conditions. Then from there, I think for all of us, there is no version of this being healthy without really just following the teachings of Jesus and saying, oh, we have to be a slave of all. Like there's just no way the executive director, if he's not like pouring his life out, you know, if she's just not like serving and washing feet, there is, and what's tricky though is, as we know, it has to be in a decentralized way. So if Lucas is only washing the feet of the staff of the organization, now he has to do that. But if he's only doing that and he's not living microchurch life, he's not reaching out to neighbors, he's not pastoring people in his living room, then that's only going to get you so far. So it does have to be this integrated servant life that actually makes sense and brings integrity. But I don't think that's an initial condition. I think that's something that can be built over time. But like Lucas, I think you just said not a long time. It can't, be like, well, you know, in 10 years.
In 10 years, right?
No. Start serving and giving your life. And that was evident. So even if people were like, I still don't really know Lucas, the people that were open to him, they started seeing him give his life away to neighbors and people and, you know, and staff. And so there was all this evidence saying, hey, this is a good person to listen to. Like this person might actually have wisdom. And actually, I'm going to give them my ear, which is a form of authority, and then eventually like submission as well. So,
yeah.
So I would say
all that stuff kind of moves towards it.
In an ecclesial context, spiritual authority is primary. Positional authority is secondary.
Yeah.
In an organizational context, positional authority is primary. Spiritual authority is secondary. What do y'all think about that?
I would say yes. My only hesitation is organizational. Well, you said primary and secondary. So you're not saying it's the other secondary thing's not there.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah. I agree.
If
sorry.
Yeah, so, I think so too.
So in my, to unpack that just a little bit, in my ecclesial context, my spiritual authority is given to me.
Yeah.
As a recognition of anointing.
Correct. Yeah.
And I walk in that only because it's given. If someone says you don't have it anymore, or we don't, well, then it's over.
Then it's not there. Yeah. Right.
But in my organizational context, you can't come to me and say you don't have authority here anymore. Yeah, I do.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes, I do. Well, you don't have spiritual authority over me. Fine. Then leave.
Yeah.
You're fired.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's secondary. Yeah. It's like, I understand if I lost your trust as a spiritual authority figure, but you still are a part of this org. Now the bigger question could be, well, then we don't need organizations guiding ecclesial context.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. That's another podcast. I'm saying it's pretty clear that in this transition, the positional authority is primary.
Yeah.
So I want to be sensitive to time and kind of the nature of the conversation. So, I mean, there's so many things that we could touch on here. I mean, I have a whole list of questions that we haven't even like looked at. And so maybe what I'll do is I'll throw out a few. And if there's like any that seem like really interesting, like, oh yeah, let's talk about that, you can go ahead. Or you could say, actually, all those questions are stupid and don't matter, and let's actually talk about this. That's fine too. But I think I had questions around, let's see if I can organize my notes here. So one, I guess I was curious, as we have talked, like, best practices around these kinds of transitions, like, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, or even just a question that we initially wrestled with as we were talking about this this episode or this subject in general, is it possible for these leadership transitions to happen in decentralized networks, or is it that you're just always starting over with every new leadership transition? So I guess that's an option. But if there is a way to do this, like, what are the best practices? Do the founders need to leave, like you would see in like a traditional church, like the pastor kind of steps out of the community so that the church can adapt to their new leader? Does that still apply in sort of these decentralized networks? So like, that's a question that I have. Another question that I had was like, just, it seems to me that a lot of what founders do, is there is a lot of DNA, as we've talked about, there's a lot of language development that happens, from the founder. And so then if that's the case, and what's the role of the first director post founder? So if a lot of the language DNA came from the original person, what does the person stepping in, what's their role? Like, do they continue building on what's already been established? Should they be trying to make their own way? How important, how critical is it that the person who's taking over is equally as apostolic as the person that was formerly in leadership? So I was thinking about maybe, was it Clayton Christensen who wrote Innovator's Dilemma, Innovator's DNA? I don't know, one of those books. I just remember him, I think it was him, talking about like innovative companies needing an innovative person to take over after the innovator. I don't know, whatever. You get what I'm saying. But yeah, how important is it that the person who's taking over is equally apostolic? I don't know. Those are some of the questions that I had rolling around. Like, what's the role of first director after founder? Should they be thinking about making their own mark? Should they be trying to just further the aims of the organization? Does the original founder need to leave? What are best practices? You guys can, I don't know, have a field day with that.
That goes off one of yours. Jeremy, go from your perspective, are there major directional shifts that the guys like Tomi and Lucas have led since some of the transitions that have occurred within your network?
Directional shifts, I would say, not at the bones, not in the bones. So the bones of the underground, I would say no. But some of the implementation, there would be continuity from like the deepest core convictions of what we should be about. But they have to start making their own decisions about, you know, implementation and how does that really look for the modern age. I think the primary example is like really taking a deeper swing at like area collectives. I think that's the newest, biggest initiative that I would say, right, that's something that you could say maybe we tried with St. Pete Underground, but not really, you know. And this, their version of it is, you know, it's coherent, cohesive, you know, it's a better swing at it, you know, and then some of the formatting of our gathering spaces, I think, has changed. But we've always changed those regularly, but right. They have to have their own version of it.
It's probably helpful, right? That you guys had a theology of change sort of built in.
Yes, I think so. I also think it, you know, to have maybe some of the founders be like, no, though, they have to make their own mistakes. Like, we've made our mistakes. They have to make their own mistakes. It's all good. You know, it's not even like they have to make their own innovations. Those innovations have to be like better than sliced bread. Yeah. It's like, no, it's all good, man. Like, make some decisions and there's going to be mistakes mixed in there. And that's great. You know, from my perspective, I'm not sure that the founders have to leave, but I do wonder if they have to maybe leave the organization. I do wonder about that, you know. But if the ecosystem is set up in such a way where you could still be organically involved, overlapping, available, that type of thing, you still be an influencer, but not necessarily like a director or on staff or something like that. You know, I do wonder about that transition. So like losing position, but maybe not really losing spiritual authority. Don't remove the founders from the spiritual authority of the community. But maybe that's size. Maybe that's how decentralized it is, that maybe that would be different. If the size is smaller or if it's less decentralized, then maybe it's like it's so overlapped. The spiritual authority and position is so overlapped. Maybe that's not possible. Those are some of my thoughts.
Well, Dwell, your founders stuck around or are still around, even though they're not leading the community anymore, right?
Yeah. I mean, we kept them in certain roles. When I say we, I really mean they, because they actually structured it that way. They planned their own exit. So they both still teach at some of our hub like central gatherings. But we have like 9 of those, and so they teach regularly at a couple of those. But neither is an elder, neither is any kind of executive leadership role. They're not in any of the email groups. Like, you know, they don't attend meetings. We occasionally like we'll hit them up for advice, but that's about it. So they completely extracted themselves from organizational and even past and even I guess like top level pastoral leadership. But they both still lead house churches. And they both do still have limited teaching roles. So, I don't know. I guess that's not totally dissimilar to what Jeremy's describing, but feels similar.
I think it's like Yellowstone. I mean, if you've ever watched 1883, when Tim McGraw founded Yellowstone, it was a gritty process. He had to fight for everything. He was fighting against all the nonsense and the culture, and he had to build from the ground up, and generation by generation it changed. It carried a different role, a different process, and like that father to son journey in the organization and the familial paradigm, it changes from generation to generation. So like I would say in my family, in large part, my older brother and I were breaking a lot of generational curses in our establishment of our family that goes back 5-10 generations. So if we just look at the underground, perhaps because 3 of y'all are on here as a framework for this conversation, the founding of it was breaking a lot of generational curses that existed within the ecclesial family. If I do a decent job of this new foundation, my son should not have to do the same things that I did. He should not have to fight the same battles. He can innovate from a more stable platform. He can innovate in a different way, his son in a far different way than him. But the old adage does come into play that hard times create strong men create soft times create weak men create hard times. And so I do think all of our movements will have a lifespan in some way, form, or fashion. And yeah, the answer to your questions, all of them for me, told me were both. Yes to both. They should innovate, but they should also build on the platform, honor the father. I sure as hell hope that my sons and daughters build on the platform that I laid for them, build on the foundation that I laid for them. But I hope they make it better. They innovate. And if they struggle, if they can learn to create resilience and struggle in their own family's life, I think they can prolong the unraveling of this foundation. But if they decide to do what the prevailing model of church has done and just rest in the laurels of those who protested and laid this foundation and then just suck up all the money and comfort and luxury that they can from this pure foundation, then yeah, it's going to fall apart and somebody's going to have to innovate a new thing. So we're just kind of we're asking, a question that's two down. The question is are we building on a faithful foundation? If so, it's that like I'm taking what my father built or founded, Yellowstone, and I'm innovating it to the culture, the context, the moment. You guys know this. the protests that we had in 2012 aren't very good protests right now. You feel me? So you got to innovate. You got to change language. The zeitgeist is different. So if you don't have an innovative gene in you, you're dead. But yes, you hold to the you honor, man, what this guy, he came from nowhere and built on nothing. And it's broken and it's nasty and there's no architecture to hold it together. So now you start to put in those modes. And then your sons come and they build on that. And hopefully their sons don't just sit in the comfort of what's been built. If they do, it will die.
Yeah, Lucas and Tommy, man, don't be trying to soak up all the money. You know what I'm saying? All that money we made.
Hey.
Living that luxury.
You laugh, but you're one generation away from
it. Right.
Watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
What you can't soak up money when there is no money though. That's all. We ain't got no
you're
money.
One generation away from it.
Yeah, I feel like the turnover from a founder or something like that to a second generation leader, or even the question of like Tommy and I like leading some kind of significant change. I feel like if Tommy or I were going to try to significantly change like the bones of the organization, or if a leader was going to try to do that, they probably wouldn't be an option for the position, you know, or. Like, you know, they probably wouldn't actually be hired if they weren't interested in the bones, you know, and believing in the bones. Yeah. Yeah. I did, when I was in the transition,
unless Lucas, the emotions too tied into the people, right? Like think of your story.
Yeah.
Decide I'm going with them instead of this. That could have been, that could have been kind of easy for you, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Right. Yeah,
you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
you held to the vision.
Right, but I was already in the position at that point. I'm just saying, like, to bring somebody in to the position in the first place, like
person
would have to have some 100% kind of interest.
Yeah. But I'm saying that can shift quicker than you think.
Totally, totally. Yeah, yeah. I actually did an independent study at Fuller at the same time that I was transitioning from Illinois into Tampa. And the research question of that independent study was, you know, what it takes to take over for a founder of a decentralized network of churches. And is it possible? A lot of the research in like just general organizational dynamics was if it like through history and even like modern and I wasn't just nailing in on like Christian organizations. It was more just like general organizational dynamics in nonprofit and for-profit sector. But the general consensus was that like founders have the second hardest time in the life of an organization. The people who take over for founders have the hardest time, and then the third generation leader has the best time.
And then it dies.
Yeah, no, correct. 100%. Yes. Because the founding leader has to grit and grind and go through hell, but they also see the progress. Like they see something born and grow. So the experience of leadership of the founder is hard, but they also see like a bunch of growth and progress, or else there wouldn't be something to pass off. And in general, again, these are generalizations. They're just evidence-based generalizations. But the people who take over for a founder, their best and primary task is to help the organization disentangle from the founder and to create a path for there to be a third leader. Like they're essentially buffers. Like a lot of sociologists would basically call that second leader a buffer, a transitional leader. And what they do is they essentially like navigate sabotage, like relational sabotage, emotional sabotage. They help sift the organization to transition to life beyond the founder, but they don't see any progress like toward the vision or goal. They like survival is basically the best possible thing you could imagine. And then they hand over the organization to like a third leader. Now, I don't necessarily think you should close your grip around that data and say this is definitely like you should prepare for that or something like that. It's sort of a grim situation, but
I think it's really accurate.
No, correct. Yeah. No.
unless the second yeah. leader goes ahead and moves to becoming the third.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But that research, I think, and really grateful to Fuller for making it possible for me to do that directed study. But I think that directed study was actually like really critical in helping me survive like a really, a difficult two or three years. Cause it helped, set my expectations a little bit. Like to go in with like a healthy sobriety about what, you know, and a lot of times what organizational theorists describe as an organization that died because of founder's trap, it is essentially bringing in a second leader who couldn't withstand what was necessary. It wasn't founder's trap.
Right.
It was hiring a weak leader, that couldn't buffer and couldn't carve away. So that shouldn't be blamed on the founder, you know.
Does this come back to the sociopathic?
Yeah,
mildly sociopathic.
Absolutely,
that's what we need. Leader number two, are you mildly
sociopathic? Well, the question is, perfect. Even though you're joking, the question is that weakness? I don't know if that's weakness.
Yeah, that's something. True. Yeah,
because if I hand the battlefield over to you, Lucas, and you're too connected to the people that are falling.
Right.
But I don't know that that's weakness. You just weren't, who we needed in that moment.
And that at the time. Yeah.
And that's a whole conversation of like, well, should we have even been on the battlefield or why are people dying?
Right,
and
right.
Got it. Understand what kind of war are we in? All that's a worthy question. But what I'm saying is if you can't move forward when we need it most, I don't know that I would use the term weakness. I would just say you're not proper.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So in summary,
like an equipping.
Mildly sociopathic.
Yeah.
Everything is bad. And
everything is bad. Everything is
bad. You better not mess it up.
Yeah, right.
And it will die.
And it will die.
Yeah.
I don't even know that it shouldn't die.
This is a very, very hopeful, optimistic episode we have here.
No, I'm with Taylor on this one. You guys, I'm on record, man. In the Philippines, when we were designing the Bones of the Underground, I said we need to write a death date to the Underground Network.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, because I'm just like, it's going to die one day. We should just go ahead and just say that this is the date. Liquidate the assets. Give it to the children. Give them the inheritance. Let them rethink it up.
Well, that's profound, Jeremy, because there does come a point where we, and I don't think any of you are exempt from this, where we hold on to our movement more than we do the presence of God. And so I just think we're all not only susceptible to this, I almost feel like it's inevitable. And so but just for clarity, because I know we're tongue in cheek, but this isn't a matter of hopelessness. This is only hope. I'm saying our only hope is to know that what we found and lead eventually needs to die so that it goes into the soil. That's like me saying, hey, son, I'm eventually going to die. And my son saying, well, that sounds really hopeless, Dad. No, this is a part of the life cycle of movement. My life, my body is a movement. It dies and it reproduces something great. So anyway, I don't think this is hopelessness at all. I know y'all don't either, but I am saying like everything has a life cycle.
And I also think every movement and every microchurch needs the eschaton. Like we need eschatology. We need the return of Jesus.
Yeah.
And so if we hold too tightly to our movements and leadership succession plans or whatever, it's a form of like functional atheism. Yeah. It's saying like we don't need the return of Christ. What we need is us to be better leaders or better organizations or something. So it's okay that it has a life cycle. Now it's okay for us to be sad, you know, when the day comes that we got to like lay grandma to rest. That's a super sad day.
Yep. altered.
But in Jesus, in Christ Jesus, there's hope in Christ. Like, we need the hope of his return and the resurrection from the dead and to set things all right. Right. So I just think that's got to be imported too, and not just, you know, John Maxwell leadership principles for life and
right,
stuff like
right.
that.
I don't know if y'all have heard Halter's story of the Denver stuff, but they tried to do all of this that we're talking about, and Hugh stepped away like it was going to carry on, blah, blah, blah. All, he can fill in the details later on another podcast with y'all. But they realized, right or wrong, they realized, no, this is over. Adullam is over. And so they had like a funeral. They had like a last service with a eulogy, and they ended it. And everybody went out and started doing new movement stuff. So I actually think that story is amazing. And I don't know when that time comes for anyone. It could be 100 years. It could be 20. For them, it was, I think, year 12 or 13. But to have the courage to say, this has run its course, I would tell any movement leader or movement successive leader or third or whatever, at least have the courage to say it's time.
I think it's an act of courage and faith to do that work. And I think it's a good work. Like, there's a way that you can pass away that's not faithful. And there's a way that you can pass away faithfully. And I think that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It is a bit grim. We are talking about leadership transition with the hope of not doing that. But at some point in some type of transition, it's going to be, it needs to be laid to rest.
But the only,
and that can be faithful and good.
The only thing that's grim, though, is an intangible, like, it's an organization. If Dwell ends, Josh isn't done. He's not nothing's grim about that, except something that we don't even care about.
Yeah, especially since he's wearing that Wu-Tang Clan shirt. He ain't done.
So
he ain't gonna stop.
Plant him.
Hey, those are good questions, Tommy.
Well, guys, I certainly do appreciate you all being on this podcast. You all duking it out, Fight Club style, figuring out, you know, what do we make of all this talk about leadership transitions? And hopefully, as microchurch and network leaders hear this podcast, maybe it's not helpful to you right now, but you, I don't know, mark it, bookmark it, and come back to it years from now when maybe it is a little bit more helpful or relevant to your situation. But guys, this has been Microchurches. Until next time.